Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Michael Robinson. His work focuses on the protection and recovery of top predators like Mexican gray wolves and jaguars. He's been associated with the Center for Biological Diversity since its founding and joined the staff in 1997. He holds a master's degree in literature from the University of Colorado at Boulder. By the way, I grew up in Boulder. And a bachelor's from the University of Texas at Austin. He's also the author of a well-reviewed book on the history of wolves in the United States called Predatory Bureaucracy, The Extermination of Wolves and the Transformation of the West. Today we're going to talk about ocelots. So thank you first for being on the program, and thank you most especially for your work in defense of the wild.
Well, thank you, Derek. I'm happy to be able to talk with ocelots about ocelots with your audience, share that information with your audience, and happy for your interest in the plight of these small, beautiful carnivores.
So probably a lot of people may have heard the word ocelot, but they have certainly never seen one and maybe never even seen a picture. So can you just, like, who are they?
They're about house cat size. They're beautiful spotted animals, golden and black, modeled so as to be camouflaged in a thick brush. They evolved to be able to lie very still and hunt for rabbits, birds, lizards, rodents. And they occupy the a huge range, originally 22 nations, and the northern portion of their range is in Texas and in Arizona, where they're both on the verge of blinking out.
So are they the 22 nations originally, how far north did their range extend prior to European conquest?
It's unclear. There's reports of in Arkansas and Louisiana, but the Fish and Wildlife Service does not necessarily consider them confirmed ocelots. There's reports in northern Arizona extending close to the border with Utah, but again, those are not confirmed. So the range could have extended considerably further. There's actually archaeological evidence in the form of pottery in Missouri that conceivably could be an ocelot or a jaguar from hundreds of years ago, and other evidence from early people who occupied this continent farther afield. But in terms of confirmed range, we just know the middle of Arizona and south central Texas as the northern extent.
And currently, are they still, what's the current range in the United States?
The Rio Grande Valley of Texas supports two isolated ocelot populations that total something on the order of maximum of three dozen animals. They're about 20 or 25 miles from each other, and it's an area that's been where the original thorn scrub brushy forest has been largely cleared for agriculture originally and for pasture, and more recently because of a pattern of urban sprawl that's developing across the whole region, and of course extensive human population growth that's leaving ocelots less and less room where they can hide and hunt and breed, and more danger when they actually venture out and into areas that are more developed with the possibility of meeting ocelots from the other population. So it's a fairly dire situation, and ocelots are dying on roads in Texas, and it's unclear whether they can continue to replenish themselves, particularly because the habitat destruction is ongoing, and there are additional threats such as the border wall that cuts them off from what was previously a continuous population with ocelots in northern Mexico, also in the Rio Grande Valley area and further south. Just to jump from Texas to Arizona, there was very few records originally of ocelots in Arizona only one that was confirmed back from 1964 in a southern Arizona mountain range, a Sky Island mountain range called the Huachucas, where an ocelot was known to have been killed. And on that basis, Arizona was considered occupied range. But more recently, there have been ocelots that have been repeatedly photographed at, both by trip cameras and by live individuals in the same mountain range, the Huachuca mountain range. And unfortunately, an ocelot killed on a road about 100 miles north of there in an area that wasn't confirmed ocelot habitat before, near the eagle. I'm thinking about a different land feature, but essentially northeast of Phoenix, near Globe, Arizona.
That's quite a ways north.
Yeah, and shows one of the perils for ocelots venturing into what may have been originally historical habitat, even an area that was much less, that is much less developed than is happening in the lower Rio Grande Valley. The animal did not survive, at least the one animal that we know of.
So you're mentioning the lower Rio Grande Valley, and I actually don't know what that particular biome is like. Is that still desert area, or is that a more wet area?
It's thorn scrub forest, so it is desert area, but it's also the Rio Grande Valley cuts through, and that of course was a rich riparian area that has been drastically transformed as well, not the least of which by the wall that now cuts through it. And the thorn scrub away from the riparian itself is a hot, dry habitat.
Well, one reason I'm asking about that is I also know that there are times when the Rio Grande no longer reaches the ocean. So has the habitat also been devastated by the lack of water in the river, or has that not been a problem for the ocelots?
Well, it certainly has been a problem because the entirety of the, or not the entirety, but large sections of the lower Rio Grande have been transformed by agriculture, and of course upstream agriculture has had a big effect. There are national wildlife refuges that have done a tremendous job of maintaining and in recent years also increasing ocelot habitat within their boundaries through habitat restoration efforts and programs. And that has staved off, a far worse fate and a faster ride in the direction of extinction. But nonetheless, those national wildlife refuges are, small part of the landscape ultimately.
So tell me more about ocelots in particular. Are they generally shy that no one would see them? Are they nocturnal? Are they if there are ocelots in the area, will you hear them? Will you see them? Are they like coyotes that they will sometimes even just walk up to you, or walk up near you, or are they not like that at all?
They're not like that at all. They are a very cryptic animal. That's part of their hunting strategy. And, of course, they're, not the largest carnivore that's out there. There certainly are much larger cats that occupy their range, including mountain lions and jaguars originally. And so they do stay hidden. They are nocturnal. And in many cases, we know of an ocelot's presence because it is hit on a roadway at night. It also, of course, makes it harder to research them. Some of the research that has been done has looked at trying to extrapolate the known population, deaths from that are known of ocelots to actual population numbers, and looking at possible ocelot occurrences where you don't have, where you just have a sighting but not a confirmed occurrence, and trying to figure out how many there are out there, but it's not an exact science.
And so we've been talking about the ocelots in the United States. Let's talk about the ocelots in the rest of their range. And the ocelots here, as you've just made clear, are not doing very well. How are they doing across the rest of their range generally?
Well, again, there isn't all that complete information. We certainly know that habitats throughout Central and South America have been transformed through through many causes, agriculture and human population growth and certainly poaching. And ocelots originally were heavily hunted and trapped for their beautiful skins. And that trade appears to have largely been dampened. It certainly is against the law and has been now for many decades, internationally as well as in the United States. Presumably there is still some market for it. I'm not aware that that is a significant portion of the threat. The main threats are destruction of habitats and perhaps sort of random persecution, but a lot of that's really not tracked, so I'm speculating to some extent about that. But we know that, you know, forests and all kinds of habitats throughout the Americas and elsewhere are being transformed very rapidly. So what the United States Fish and Wildlife Service has done is put some focus on recovery of ocelots that occur, whose ranges occur in the United States, but we believe quite insufficient focus, and we're trying to change that.
So another question I have, just generically, and I'm sorry if a lot of these questions are too basic, but I interviewed someone about jaguars a few weeks ago, and one of the things he was mentioning I found really interesting was that there's a dramatic size difference in jaguars between the northern part of their range and the ones found in the, for example, the Amazon, that they can be, like, it seems like, I don't remember the number, like three times as big, twice as big. And do ocelots also have a size? Is there a significant difference between the ones in the north and the ones that, so here they're in so drier areas. Do they live in rainforests as well? Do they,
Live in rainforests, they live in pine forests, pine highlands. In Mexico, they inhabit a variety of different habitats, and similar to, in some respects, to jaguars, which also inhabit quite a wide variety of habitats. I don't know the definitive answer in terms of the size difference. I do know that ocelots are divided into several subspecies, but I do not know the specific measurements, morphological measurements that were used in the subspeciation identification process. Oftentimes in decades past, and I'm speaking generally because, again, I'm not familiar with the history of the ocelot taxonomy, but oftentimes in the past, very subtle differences in cranial shape and dentition and pelage and things that one wouldn't notice unless one had a dead cat in hand or a dead animal in hand were used to differentiate animals in ways that have not necessarily held up under more modern genetic testing. Nonetheless, there are several subspecies, and in fact, the ones in Texas are a different subspecies than the ones in Arizona.
I'm sorry again if you've already said this, but what is the actual Endangered Species Act status of ocelots in the United States?
They are listed as endangered, and they have been for decades, since the before the passage of the Endangered Species Act, since 1972, under the authority of a predecessor law to the Endangered Species Act, a law that actually had very little teeth to it, and then they retained that they were then listed in the United States specifically in 1982 as an endangered species under the authority of the Endangered Species Act.
And what is being done? What are some good things that are being done, if any, to protect them apart from the existence of the wildlife refuges? And what are some good things that are either being done or being attempted to be done?
Yeah, and there certainly are some good things. They just, as I said, insufficient. And I think the wildlife, what's happening on the Laguna Escoza Wildlife National Wildlife Refuge, as well as the Lower Rio Grande National Wildlife Refuge, is significant in terms of habitat, you know, getting rid of noxious invasive plants and replanting native plants, closing unnecessary roadways, and making the habitat really as good as can be in the modern world for ocelots. So that is an important step. There are plans underway to fence one of the most lethal highways in southern Texas for ocelots. It's Highway 100, and to install underpasses. And that is really way overdue. We have had in the last couple of years yet another ocelot lost on that, killed on that highway. And it really it bisects an area where ocelots should be able to move across, where there's good habitat on both sides. So there are plans and the intents to get that fencing done, but it may take as long as 2 years to get it done. We're talking about, you know, a very few number of ocelots that are left. So that needs to be expedited so that the fencing and the underpasses get installed as the fencing gets erected and the underpasses get installed as quickly as possible to save ocelots from that roadway. And that needs to be done on other roadways as well. And there really needs to be a curb on development of new roadways. There's a proposal for a new highway that would State Highway 32, which does not exist, but is being proposed, that would cut through ocelot habitat. And that is a very poor idea. We think the Fish and Wildlife Service can exercise its authority more robustly than it has to save ocelots. In 2010, they developed a draft ocelot recovery plan. And from our perspective, it's really not going to get the job done to save ocelots from extinction. At the same time, I've got to say they haven't even finalized it. It's 5 years later, and it's still in draft form. Even though we and others submitted comments, and many of our members wrote in as well when we encouraged them to do so. So the criteria are insufficient for a couple of different reasons, each of them specific to the two populations in the United States. In Arizona, where we know of just a few ocelots, you know, perhaps less than a full handful, so to speak, perhaps less than five, in existence in the Huachuca Mountains and perhaps elsewhere in the state, they have a criteria of no ocelots in the United States would need to be present to allow delisting, taking them off of the endangered species list. They would require 1,000 ocelots to live south of Arizona in Sonora, Mexico, and require that population be stable or increasing. But the sad thing is that's actually fewer than they estimate live there at present. So they would allow a decline in the number of ocelots in Sonora and be able to take them off the endangered species list. The estimate, 1,350 to 2,000 ocelots living in Sonora. Again, that reflects the fact that they are very hard to study, and there hasn't been, you know, huge resources put into studying them. So that would allow, you know, a decline of perhaps 350 if the population is low, or a much more substantial decline if the population is at the high end. And that doesn't make sense that a species that's endangered should be taken off the endangered species list if it actually loses numbers. In Texas, they have sort of a two-pronged recovery goal, in other words, a delisting threshold. One of them would be at least 150 ocelots in one population or connectivity. That would connectivity between presumably the two existing separated populations, plus some level of interchange with ocelots south of the border in the provinces in Mexican province of Tamaulipas, and that they say that connectivity could be achieved not just through natural means, which is very, very difficult because there's a border wall at present, albeit there are some very small areas where ocelots could pass. But they say that in the alternate, that translocation, human movement of ocelots could suffice with 150 in the U.S. Or alternately, if there is no connectivity to ocelots in Mexico, that there would have to be 225 in the United States. And that's really woefully inadequate as well, because scientists have shown that there has to be far more animals of any type than in the low hundreds to ensure genetic viability, to ensure that over the long run, traits that are not lethal or deleterious to an animal's survival don't predominate because there's too few animals out there to mate with and interchange genes with. So 225 is really inadequate to the task of saving ocelots in the long term.
And you've talked about numbers here, and does the recovery plan talk about increasing habitat?
It does talk about stabilization and restoration of habitat, and that's part of the, you know, that's part of the subtext of what needs to be done in order to achieve those numbers. But it doesn't. The problem is that another facet of the problem is that Fish and Wildlife Service is not designating critical habitat for ocelots under its authority that it has through the Endangered Species Act. And critical habitat would enable projects that have a federal nexus. In other words, projects where federal funds are subsidizing something, or where there's a permitting for destruction of wetlands, for example, or other things that have a tie-in to a federal authority, such projects would have to undergo consultation to ensure that they wouldn't destroy or harm the critical habitat. But without designated critical habitat, there's no such review process.
And, you know, you've mentioned the word wall a few times, and can you talk more explicitly about the effects of the border wall on ocelots? And feel free to jump to other creatures too. Please actually jump to other creatures as well and talk about what does the future hold for the wall and as regards wildlife?
Well, it is a huge problem for many species of wildlife. It's an 18-foot structure that's made of metal, and it's it bisects the landscape. And ocelots are, as I said, a house cat size, a little bit larger, but certainly much larger animals cannot bound over an 18-foot wall. In fact, the former governor of New Mexico acutely noted that it basically would stop every, and this is not a direct quote, but it would stop every creature except human beings with ladders, and that's proven to be the case. It's a futile gesture that has enormous ecological consequences. So ocelots in Texas were part of a population, of course, that originally stretched thousands of miles south, and are now almost entirely cut off, and perhaps entirely cut off from ocelots of the same subspecies in Tamaulipas. In Arizona, there are sections of the state that have been walled off, and other sections that thankfully do not have a wall. Some of them have other infrastructure that's harming wildlife, and there's different types of fencing that is semi-permeable at least for wildlife, but stops vehicles. So there are different challenges out there. But in terms of the wall itself, which is an absolute barrier to wildlife, it certainly blocks, has the potential to block jaguar movements. Although thankfully there are some very important habitats in Arizona that have not been walled off. There's a variety of creatures. Cactus ferruginous pygmy owls tend to fly fairly low to the ground and would likely be harmed by the wall. Bats as well. Animals one wouldn't even necessarily think of. And certainly Mexican gray wolves are likely in the future to be harmed by the wall because the Republic of Mexico has begun reintroducing that animal since 2011 and hopes for its viability, as well as hopes for the viability of Mexican wolves that have been reintroduced into the United States, rest on connectivity for genetic reasons.
So I just heard Donald Trump announce his presidency a couple days ago, and one of the things he was talking about was expanding the wall. And leaving aside Trump, what do you see as the future of that particular barrier to wildlife passage? Do you see it getting worse? Do you see somehow it getting not so bad? What do you see happening and I'm not asking for I know the crystal ball is cloudy, so I'm just asking for your informed guess, really.
Well, it really is a political decision. I mean, there's three broad paths forward. There's the status quo, in which periodically the wall is breached by water, by floods that certainly have been you know, waterways have been altered by the by construction of the wall, and the direction of water has been changed. But nonetheless, the wall has been undercut by water as well. So there's the status quo. It's you know could continue to be maintained. There's the option you just mentioned, which is extension of it into areas that are not walled off. That's an extraordinarily expensive proposition for the American people, among its other problematic features. It's already been estimated to be a $2 million per mile construction project where it has been built, and that doesn't count the ongoing maintenance that is required. And it's been built in some of the most level and accessible grounds. So when you go into some of the canyon country of Arizona, for example, or New Mexico, it becomes a dicier proposition. Now, the ecological consequences would be absolutely, you know, would compound the catastrophic effect that has already occurred. And to me, it's unthinkable. But certainly it would confine many species into fragmented populations. It would forego the possibility of jaguar recovery in the United States, and many other species as well would probably eventually go extinct. Certainly in part due to that, if the wall was to be completed across the entire border, as I believe some candidates for president advocate. And there is a third way, and Congressman Raul Grijalva of Tucson, Arizona, and surrounding rural areas, extensive rural areas in southeastern Arizona, has proposed. And that is removing portions of the wall for the ecological and fiscal reasons that I briefly went over. And I really think that is the way forward. And what is striking is that a large majority of people who live near the wall very much dislike it. And you see that in election results over and over and over the years.
So let's presume for a second, and I'm sorry if this is too ignorant a question, but let's presume for a second that the wall is going to stand for the short term. You mentioned tunnels under roads. Would it be possible to make I want to be clear that I'm not accepting the fundamental premise of the wall when I ask this question, I'm not taking an anti-immigration stance. I want to be very clear that I'm not. I'm just simply saying the wall exists. That's all I'm saying. So presuming the existence of the wall, are there ways to make animal passages just as there are regarding roads?
Well, I hadn't thought about that, and presumably at least for the smaller animals, one could construct something that a human couldn't get through. But that wouldn't solve the problem for a larger animal such as a jaguar.
Right.
Or probably even a Mexican wolf. If you were to make something large enough for those animals, probably a person could get through them as well. And, you know, I don't know how the Department of Homeland Security would look on such a project, but I think your guess is right that we are going to have the status quo for at least the immediately foreseeable future. And I don't really see that as something that the agencies are going to jump on. Instead, what we see is the Fish and Wildlife Service talking about translocation of ocelots, moving them, you know, capturing them from the wild and moving them to the, you know, south or vice versa. So that seems to be more the orientation that the agencies would have towards mitigating the wall's effects.
And you don't have to talk about this if you don't want, but I'm just wondering what you think about translocation, because I generally really I work more on salmon issues, for example. I mean, I live in the Northwest, so of course I'm going to work more on salmon issues than ocelot issues. And I generically have some problems with the whole notion of trucking salmon around as opposed to removing dams. But I also know, I mean, I'm not a purist, and I also know I'm really in favor, for example, of the captive breeding programs that have helped black-footed ferrets to survive. And so, I mean, what do you think about translocation? Do you feel mixed as I do, or what do you think about it?
Well, I feel much the same as you. I don't think we can afford to be purists when it comes to recovery actions. And I think translocation certainly includes, in many cases, reintroduction. And I think human intervention is an important component of conservation these days, bringing animals back, bringing plants back, removing non-native species, both plants and animals, that do damage. So we have to limit our own appetites as a species, and we also have to undo some of the damage that's already been done and some of the forces that we've unleashed. And translocation is certainly, is a valuable tool. What I find of concern is the notion that after the animals are recovered, that you would have a strategy of continuing, ongoing, forever translocation to ensure that that populations don't disappear due to inbreeding. And that strikes me as inconsistent with the noble goals of the Endangered Species Act to conserve the ecosystems on which threatened species and endangered species depend. And part of that conservation of ecosystems is allowing the dynamic processes, including animals going back and forth, to continue as they were. So it's about the, it's a good means, translocation, to save species such as ocelots, but it shouldn't be something that we count on forever, and then allow all the other problems around ocelots to compound once we take them off the endangered species list.
Well, and this really takes us to, I think, the bottom line for, I would say almost all, I'm not going to say all, but almost all endangered species recovery, which is habitat. And what do you see for the near-term future for habitat in both of those two populations for the ocelots? Well, actually, I have a question before that, which is, I just want to be explicit. What are the primary limiting factors to the population of ocelots? Let's talk about the one in Texas first. What are the primary limiting factors? Are the primary limiting factors habitat itself, or is it the wall, or is it mortality by car? What are the primary? If you were in charge of ocelot recovery, what of those would you focus on first?
Well, really all of them, and not to be too overwhelmed, but climate change is also playing a factor because drought is exacerbating all of the problems and reducing the quality of existing habitat. In terms of what I would focus on immediately, it would be reducing road mortality, fencing off Highway 100 and getting underpasses in there on a much more expedited scale, designating critical habitat so that there's some kind of rational planning that incorporates ocelots' needs as well as human needs in South Texas, rather than just the pell-mell development that's happening at the moment. And finalizing the recovery plan so that one can actually go forward with a long-term vision of what needs to be done for ocelots. And that recovery plan, needs to grapple, I think, a little bit more deeply with the problems that ocelots face, including a low number of ocelots and the lack of connectivity. So the recovery plan should call for breaching the border wall, even if it's not within the authority of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to actually accomplish that. And the recovery plan should call for critical habitat designation, which is within the authority of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to accomplish. And the recovery plan, which is largely focused on the ocelots in Texas, which are in dire need, needs to take a broader look at the opportunities for ocelot conservation and recovery in Arizona as well, and establish some goals in Arizona, establish reasonable goals in Sonora rather than goals that would allow a decrease in the ocelot numbers, and concurrently, start developing a strategy for habitat protection and protection of corridors between different mountain ranges in southern and central Arizona.
So it's generally, it's really, I've lived my whole life in the West, and it's been very clear, as you've written a book about this, that there has been a war against wolves. And of course, on a larger scale, there's been a war against nature, but we'll leave that aside for a second. I asked the person I interviewed about jaguars, if jaguars are as hated as wolves, and he said that that's not his experience. And a different interview, I'd love to interview again about the war against wolves specifically, and talk, among other things, about why this hatred of wolves. But are ocelots, among the people who live near there, do they just not think about them, or do they like them, or do they hate them? What's the relationship? I never hear about ocelots being hated, are they?
I don't think so. I mean, I think in olden times when there were a lot more of them, they were certainly the kind of animal that would take a chicken that was loosely guarded or something like that. But I don't believe that there was widespread hatred of ocelots. Certainly they were killed for their pelts. Just an absolutely stunning pattern of, as I said, gold and black and spots. And so they were trapped and killed for that reason. And, there was an era in U.S. history where, a rifle was raised at pretty much anything that moved and was seen. But as I said, ocelots were not necessarily seen all that often, either now or originally. So I think there really were different dynamics at play with ocelots than with wolves.
And there, I mean, just looking at pictures of them, they pretty much look like the definition of a charismatic creature. I mean, they're as you've said several times, they're absolutely gorgeous. Why do you think people have not heard more about them, or have people heard more about them? Why are they not, when there's only, how many of them are there in the United States now? 50, 55, 60?
Well, probably well less than that at this point. Two or three dozen at the max.
Okay, so 35, 20 to 30. Why are they not spoken of more often when they are so critically endangered? And also they have the advantage of being, I mean, they're not freshwater mussels, who may be very important, but people don't think of them as cute.
Well, it's a good question, and I think some of the answers to that are larger than ocelots. I think everyone's attention is very fragmented at the moment, and there's certainly many things demanding people's attention aside from conservation in any sphere. But ocelots, as I said, are cryptic. They exist now certainly along the border or close to the border, although we were surprised to know of the ocelot killed northeast of Phoenix. I think the fact that they haven't been seen much, they haven't been researched much, and there hasn't been much, the activity that has been done for their conservation, laudable as it has been on national wildlife refuges that are dedicated to conservation, so perhaps there's been less conflict. All of those reasons may have contributed to the ocelot's anonymity, but right now they need our help.
So you've said a couple times now the depopulation. Can you tell me population trends over the last, say, 30 years? So what was the population in the United States in, just guesstimates or whatever, 1980, 2000, and now?
Of ocelot numbers?
Yeah, is the trend bad? Is the question?
Yeah,
really?
It is bad. I mean, I don't have those numbers precise. I could look at the 1982 listing rule, but I don't remember what the numbers were estimated to be at that time. But clearly, the numbers are going down. Yes.
So the point is that there are 20 to 30, and it's declining. It's not 20 to 30, but there were 15.
Maximum 20 to, it's 2 to 3 dozen.
Right.
I mean, it could be lower than that.
And it sounds, just from the research I've done on them, it sounds like, given habitat and given not being killed by cars, that they do have a couple, three kittens per litter, and so they can, given the right habitat and everything else, can they reproduce okay quickly?
Yes.
So given the right, given habitat, given critical habitat, given lack of mortality, and also given large enough numbers, obviously 20 to 30 is a genetic nightmare, but given large enough numbers, they could actually recover.
Yes.
They're not like, some species of whales or elephants who reproduce incredibly slowly.
That's correct, yeah.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, just that they do have a, you know, reasonably high fertility rate.
So we have about 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 minutes left, and I've got a couple, 3 questions. One of them is, so what do you want people to do? I mean, the main reason I do these interviews is I want for people listening to them to get off their behinds and do something. And I want them to get involved in activism, whether it is on a trivial level or whether they dedicate their entire lives to it. And so if somebody, you know, listens to this interview and then they go look at an ocelot and they fall in love with it, or if they don't look at an ocelot and they still fall in love with it, if they live in either Texas or the affected regions of Texas or Arizona, what do you want them to do? Or if they live elsewhere, what do you want them to do?
Well, I think there's things that people throughout the United States can do. I mean, part of the problems that ocelots face are intertwined with larger political decisions that are being made affecting all endangered species, including the very low budget for recovery and as well as critical habitat designation that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service receives. And unfortunately, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has asked for very little money for endangered species recovery and conservation and designation of critical habitat. But that should be an issue that that people bring up with their elected representatives, their members of Congress, because the delay in approving the recovery plan apparently is at least partly caused by lack of resources for the Fish and Wildlife Service. They have a very, very small staff that's dedicated to several endangered species in South Texas, and they're doing what they can, but they don't have the resources to do what needs to be done given the plight of the ocelot. So pushing for a strong Endangered Species Act, including robust funding for recovery activities, is something that everybody can do. And people should be aware also that the Obama administration, unfortunately, has taken a very lackluster approach towards recovery and has even tried to undercut recovery of endangered species. And that's problematic through proposal of rules, for example, that would restrict if they're finalized, what species can get on the endangered species list through procedural hurdles. So these kind of obstacles generally to implementation of the Endangered Species Act need to be brought to the attention of elected representatives, and those who are driving it, including many in the Republican majority, need to be held to account, but some Democrats as well. So all need to be urged to stand up for a strong Endangered Species Act and adequate funding for the ocelot and other species of wildlife and native plants that need it. So that's one thing that people can do. And in terms of folks closer by, there are possibly volunteer opportunities on the Laguna Atascosa National Wildlife Refuge involving their habitat restoration efforts. I don't know of details at this moment, but you can certainly inquire. And in Arizona, there's efforts to map travel ways that ocelots and other animals may use and to take photographs of them. And one of the Center for Biological Diversity's partners is an organization called Sky Island Alliance, which works on conservation of the Sky Island mountain ranges, including the Huachucas and the nearby Santa Ritas, where ocelots have also been reported, and ensuring connectivity. So the Center for Biological Diversity is also fighting for those connecting ways for ocelots and jaguars. So you can join up with us and with some of the other good groups in the region that are working for conservation.
Great. And then I guess my last question for now is, if you were made king of all things ocelot and could ocelot in the United States, and you could you could basically have a wish list of things that you could do. You can't like stop all industrial agriculture, and you can't stop capitalism. We're not going to go quite that far yet, but in terms of specific policy for ocelots, it sounds like what you would do is designate the critical habitat. What would you do if you were suddenly made president and you could do whatever you want with executive order to help ocelots? What would you do?
Well, I think, as I mentioned,
and you've got funding for it too. They take money away from the military to give it to ocelots.
Well, you're granting me a lot of theoretical powers there, Derek, and I'll take them. I think expedited fencing of Highway 100 and installation of underpasses is really needs to be an immediate priority, and completing the offlot recovery plan with more biologically researched standards and thresholds for taking the offlot eventually off the endangered species list, including establishing a population in Arizona and ensuring connectivity between offlots in Texas and those in Mexico, I think, or at least moving towards connectivity, I think would be very high priorities as well. And of course, well, there needs to be a lot more research to ensure that recovery, you know, recovery planning is going the right direction, and that we can, you know, would be able to make modifications as things go along. So there's multi-pronged approaches, and perhaps not the least would be addressing climate change in a serious way. And of course, ocelots are hardly the only species of wildlife that's getting hammered by climate change.
So is there anything else that you would want for listeners of this interview to know about ocelots that I haven't asked the right question to give you a chance to say?
Well, ocelots are really part of the charm of both the lower Rio Grande Valley, the natural areas that are left of it, the possibility of seeing an ocelot, the chance of even seeing a track after a rainstorm or other sign of ocelots is exciting. It enlivens the human spirit. And the same with southern Arizona as well, the rolling oak grasslands of the Huachuca Mountains and the nearby steep forested mountains of the Santa Ritas where a jaguar near roams. The fact that there are ocelots, a small number in there, is part of the charm, part of what keeps us in love with the natural world. I think that's good for our souls as well as something that we need to always keep for the ocelots themselves.
Well, thank you so much for being on the program, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Michael Robinson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.